ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Corbin Middlemass. Have you got Ashes fever? Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It's called ABC Cricket Podcast. I'm joined by former Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of Test cricket all summer long. The Australia-England rivalry has never been bigger, so make sure you're across every angle. This is the best analysis and insights on the game, and it's coming your way. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. It's great to be with you again. Now, I want to begin this week by reflecting on how we think about conspiracy theorists and people who get sucked into online communities of extremists who trade on wild, paranoid beliefs about the world. I would suggest that many, or perhaps most of us, see such people as crazy or deficient in reason or in possession of the wrong facts or in some other way individually damaged or compromised. And that's because many or most of us see false belief as the property of the individual. It takes root in the mind of the believer and then gets passed around to the minds of other individuals who may or may not take up that false belief themselves. But we're going to be hearing today from a guest who finds that model of how belief is formed, how knowledge is formed, highly problematic. He's Chris Fleming, Associate Professor in the School of Humanities and Communication Arts at Western Sydney University. Chris Fleming believes that the notion of the disordered mind is inadequate to the task of understanding and dealing with conspiracy theories, and he has an excellent paper recently published in the journal Subjectivity titled On Doing Your Own Research, Conspiracy Theory, Distributed Intelligence, and the Ethics of Knowing. So it's been 10 years now since the first Trump campaign when things really started to get weird with the conspiracy theories, the QAnon level of intensity. And you might think that public interest would have started to wane a little, the whole thing become a little more normalized. Why are we still so interested in conspiracy theories, do you think? And specifically, why is the media so interested?
Well, I think one reason is pretty simple, is that conspiracy theories are just fantastic stories. They give you villains, secrets, plots, heroic outsiders who see through the lies. So they're thrillers that culture really writes for free. And a huge slice of popular entertainment is basically a conspiracy fantasy. So we're already primed, you know, in an action movie, if a car breaks down, it's never a faulty transmission. It's basically sabotage. And on top of that, I think conspiracy theories appeal because they relate to our own experience. We conspire all the time. Anyone who's organized a surprise birthday party has run a miniature conspiracy. And so the structure of secrecy, hidden intent, coordination, these are completely familiar to us. Conspiracy theories just scale the birthday party up until the guest list includes, you know, the UN aliens and Bill Gates. And so the media, I think, particularly loves conspiracy theorists for a different reason, and because it gives us people it's safe to look down on or laugh at. And it's comforting to believe that the problems with the world are either related to alien lizards or those mad people over there. So I think there's a few reasons why we're still attracted to them: narrative, psychological, philosophical.
Well, you co-authored with Emma Jane this excellent book in 2014 on conspiracy theory, Modern Conspiracy, The Importance of Being Paranoid. And you've written about how that book was taken up in the media. What kinds of questions were you being asked in interviews around the time that that book came out? And what do those questions suggest to you about how we typically conceive of knowledge?
Well, what struck me was how obsessively everything got framed as an individual defect. So in the media, the question often was, are these conspiracy theorists crazy? Or on more educated so-called podcasts, the psychiatric angle was swapped out for an intellectual one as, are these conspiracy theorists just stupid and lacking critical thinking skills? And what I'd want to argue is that both of these are basically the same picture. Either we live in a gigantic psych ward or in a mass remedial classroom. What nobody wanted to ask a lot of the time were about institutions, about practices, about our modes of communication. And the focus was generally on the image of a solitary mind that had somehow malfunctioned. And I think that tells us something very important about how we conceive of knowledge more generally. We tend to think of knowledge as a kind of stuff that sits inside individual heads, something you can weigh with IQ tests or diagnose in a clinical interview. And we imagine civilization as this game where one contestant has the right answer, another doesn't. But I don't think knowledge actually works like that. Knowledge isn't what a lone genius is going to spit out after Googling for 5 minutes. It's what becomes possible when people are embedded in networks of training, of critique, of accountability, of what we call the disciplines, and so on.
Right. And on this, you cite a very famous paper published in 1995 by the philosophers Andy Clark and David Chalmers. This is The Extended Mind. And I know you're not in agreement with every point of this paper, and we'll get onto that in a minute. But in that paper, I mean, it's really interesting because they directly take on this idea of the discrete individual knower. How do they conceive of the mind and how it works in that paper?
Well, Clark and Chalmers put forward an argument, it's about 25 years ago, where they argued that what we call the mind extends beyond the skull, that the mind isn't restricted to what takes place in your head, your notebook, your phone, your environment. All of these can function, they argue, as parts of your cognitive system and extends that system in important ways. And it's a really important corrective to a number of ideas in traditional epistemology. And they have a classic case of Otto, a man with Alzheimer's, whose notebook functions as his memory. And they say that the classification or the demand that all of our cognitive equipment has to take place within the skull or even within the confines of our own skin is an arbitrary designation. So they say that mind can and often is extended.
And as you say, this extends, part of this extension involves things that we wouldn't normally understand as being components of cognition. But if we look at, you know, laptops and phones and pen and paper, this kind of thing, these are all, as you put it, part of the cognitive circuitry themselves.
Yeah, that's right. And so it extends the mind in those distinct ways. My problem, I guess, is that extension keeps an old fantasy of the autonomous individual intact. It still imagines this bounded self that then reaches out to annex these tools. But I think it's a more radical situation than that. There is no epistemically autonomous self to begin with. The basic unit of cognition is already distributed through language, norms, archives, practices. So we don't use English in the way we use a screwdriver. English is our, for many of us, our operating system, not an extension somehow. It's not a tool. That intelligence that it's embedded in language, and looking at indigenous languages is particularly interesting in this respect, but these are the ways in which intelligence is in fact distributed through networks. They're not things that begin inside us and then extend outside us.
Sure. Well, there's a lot there that I want to unpack in a minute. But I'd like first just to touch on feedback loops, because these are a very interesting function of this kind of extended mind. Tell me about feedback loops and how they work.
Well, there's loops in two senses. So you and me having this conversation is a set of feedback loops where I'm trying to articulate something. You might clarify what I'm trying to say, criticize what I'm trying to say. I may hear things I say and offer, you know, a retraction or an extension. But these feedback loops, which occur in the intellectual domain, we're talking about things like peer review, supervision, editorial processes. And of course, there are quite pathological forms or a feedback loop. So the classic example of that would be the contestant who turns up on the talent show who has never had genuine feedback in their life and they don't realize at the age of 20 that they can't see and everyone laughs at them. And so we see there the failure of a particular kind of feedback loop. So they're very, very important sorts of things, forms of correction for us. And the question then has to be is, what are the quality of these feedback loops? What is the nature of these feedback loops? How do they operate within our cognitive environment? What do they tell us about what it is to know something or assert something?
It's tempting to say that the problems start to arise with feedback loops when the loop is small and closed, while open feedback loops are more conducive to securing valid knowledge. You're not on board with that idea, are you?
Well, not entirely. I mean, it might be the case that I get a whole lot of positive feedback from people who already agree with me, or I may put forward, you know, a solution to a mathematical problem, and all the feedback I get, which is overwhelmingly positive, comes from non-mathematicians, my parents, my uncle, you know, my grandparents, a good friend. And so getting the feedback in that instance from someone who knows what they're talking about may in fact be far more valuable. And this is where the question, it's not something I explicitly take up in the paper, but where the question of things like filter bubbles on social media occur. And we know that if we read, work's been done that if you read once that, you know, Bill Gates is putting nanobots into vaccines, you might blink. And we know, though, if you keep seeing versions of that story multiple times, that repetition in feedback loops tends to feel like confirmation. And so we need to ask questions about these feedback loops, the effects that they have on cognitive systems and the quality of feedback they offer.
You make some really interesting points about what you call quiz show epistemology and the way that knowledge can sometimes be misunderstood as inhering in large collections of facts, like whoever has the largest collection of facts has the greatest knowledge. Tell me more about that and how you saw that way of thinking illustrated in the Donald Trump versus Anthony Fauci battles during the height of the COVID pandemic in the US. I think this is so interesting the way you analyze this.
Well, doing your own research is that phrase that we often saw in memes, and that demand often conceives of knowledge as a stockpile of facts. If I can Google quickly and think very clearly about something, why shouldn't my views on vaccines or the climate be as good as an expert's? And so what I call quiz show epistemology is knowledge that's imagined as this game where two individuals present competing propositions and the audience decides who wins. And that's how a lot of the media, both left and right, framed Trump versus Fauci, as two contestants with differing views on virology. The fact is, though, that Fauci wasn't there as a free floating intellect with especially shiny facts, with a better IQ, although, you know, we would probably say that he was a smarter person. But the fact is that Fauci here was speaking as what I call an operator for a vast institutional network of training, modeling, peer review, accumulated tacit judgment, regulatory procedures. Trump, by contrast, was essentially a, you know, one person with strong opinions in a Twitter account. And framed as a quiz show, they essentially look equivalent, but it's a wrong-headed view about what it means to make a statement about a scientific issue. Now, it doesn't mean that Fauci's right or faultless or that there aren't problems in that system, but we need to get clear about what knowledge is and who is speaking and speaking on behalf of what. And I think it's wrong to see it as people with alternate facts battling it out in the public domain. I think it's an absurd way of seeing what's going on.
Yeah, and what we see in those battles, of course, is the expertise of the expert sort of disappearing from view, certainly disappearing from the view of the many people who decided that Fauci just didn't know what he was talking about, that he was hopelessly incompetent and compromised. What is it that renders expertise invisible in this way? You know, to the point where someone can say, yeah, this guy has been a highly credentialed and respected physician and immunologist for decades. He's got his degrees, but I've got my search engine and I can tell you he's wrong. How does that happen?
Well, it's a really interesting question, actually. And the fact is, I think I started thinking about this years ago when I had a student who plagiarized, and they went from borderline illiterate to postdoctoral within the space of a paragraph. And what really struck me was, in part, the boldness of the act of plagiarism, but the question kept occurring to me is, why can't they see the gap between their normal work and what they have basically copied out word for word? And so this, you know, goes right into the issue that a lot of the time, the techniques, the scaffolds, all the sorts of competencies that differentiate expert judgment from amateur pattern matching are largely invisible. Now, this differs across domains. Very few people are going to watch YouTube videos and then, you know, give a rugby league team a call and go, listen, you know, I'm pretty much a first grader now. Or, you know, if you don't play piano, to suddenly enter a piano competition would be absurd. But there are domains of competence in which that gap becomes much, much harder to see. The gap between an expert pianist and someone who can't play is much more obvious to most people than the gap between an epidemiologist or a statistician and the average person in the street who can watch a YouTube video. And that gap and the invisibility of that gap has huge epistemic implications, but I think it also has huge political implications and how we think about knowledge and society and collective decision making.
On ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, I'm David Rutledge. You're in the Philosopher's Zone, and we are joined by my guest, Chris Fleming from Western Sydney University. We're talking about his recent paper titled On Doing Your Own Research, Conspiracy Theory, Distributed Intelligence, and the Ethics of Knowing. Details on the Philosopher's Zone website. So back to this notion of the extended mind then. You're working with a concept of distributed intelligence, and one in which this distribution is not an extension of knowledge or cognition, but actually its origin. And we've touched on that, but let's get into it more. I mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by it is that if you think of the mind as simply extending outwards, you have accepted tacitly a Cartesian view of knowledge is of res cogitans and res extensa. It's there baked into the language. And I can see the reason you might want to adopt that model, and that is going to be at least partly related to ideas of subjectivity and subjective experience, qualia, and we think naturally that these elements of qualitative experience begin the individual. But I think when we start to talk about cognition and when we start to talk about things like expertise and knowledge, that is no longer the model that is a particularly useful model of reaching out from the individual. In fact, most of these forms of cognition that we possess are inherited, right? So we know now, for instance, that Indigenous languages and a lot of the languages of Paman languages of the Cape operate using cardinal compass directions. And so what that means is that Indigenous speakers of these languages have incredibly effective ways of orienting themselves to the environment. Now, this is not something that the person reaches out and extends. This is something that precedes them, something that they imbibe as a child and constitutes them. And that language is distributed across a network and distributed across history. It's not something that the individual starts with a kind of subjective knowing and then they reach out to use this language. Now, you might think that I'm making too much of a metaphor here, but I do think it's an important modification of the extended mind hypothesis, which I think is a great hypothesis, but can wind up engaging in distortions, which I think need some correction.
Yeah, well, as we talked about earlier, the extended mind hypothesis, as set out by Clark and Chalmers, they, I believe, refer to language as a tool for understanding in the way that, you know, we laptops and smartphones are components, tools of our cognitive makeup. Your idea of language is more something that sort of gives it an autonomy almost of its own, or maybe not even almost. Language has an autonomy.
Yeah, I think so. There's no epistemically autonomous self to begin with in most instances. The basic unit of cognition is already distributed across language, norms, and practices and so on, they don't extend a pre-existing mind. They constitute the very conditions of having one. And that is why I'd want to distinguish tools from something like an autonomous machine. So a hammer extends your arm and your fist, or however you want to conceive that, but a search engine or a language does not work like that. These reshape your habits. They reconfigure your desires. That's why we can monetize them, in a lot of instances, and even what you think. And so we don't use English like we use a screwdriver or a hammer or any of these other tools. They're fundamentally different things. And the distinction here is Paul Dumoschel's distinction between tools and autonomous machines. And I think they have very different implications for how we think of knowledge and even what it means to be a human being. In fact, I think that the idea of an extended mind might work better with some primates, non-human primates, than it does with us. But when we think about human knowing, I think the idea of distribution is a better image a lot of the time.
There are things to say here about the role of education. And with reference to that, you've made some interesting comparisons between Plato and John Locke and their ideas of knowledge. Can you take us through that?
Well, I think what you get in Plato is a connection between epistemology and the philosophy of education, which is really been obscured. It seems as even anachronistic now to connect epistemology to a philosophy of education. But Plato does do that. And so in something like the Meno, for instance, he treats learning not as stuffing a mind with propositions, but as a kind of guided process of questioning, recollection, and transformation. The teacher becomes this midwife, not a content provider. And you can read that, in fact, as a proto-account of distributed intelligence. If you want, you come to know something by being drawn into shared forms of inquiry and practice. Now, Locke, by contrast, gives us this image of a blank slate that fills itself with ideas that are drawn from experience and then surveys them to see how they agree or disagree with ideas that are already there. And so in this picture, in Locke's picture, every mind's like this little factory processing these private inputs. You know, algebra becomes, for him, and algebra is the example that I look at, becomes a matter of an individual mind discovering relations between its own ideas rather than participation in this public practice that we call mathematics, with its own norms, with its own history, and with its own standards. For Locke, this idea of a discipline or a history of inquiry seems to evaporate, and it's this autonomous mind engaged in evaluation and comparison. And I think this is a real distortion of what education is and what it means to come to know something.
It illuminates a really interesting tension, I think, between a certain ancient Greek ideal and Enlightenment ideal of just how people tick. And for Plato, of course, knowledge involves then education, which for him would have meant some sort of induction or even apprenticeship. And this is more sympathetic with the idea of distributed intelligence, distributed mind.
Yeah, I think so. And it's an extraordinarily counterintuitive thing to think, I realize, because, you know, Plato is considered buried, and the Meno in particular is considered buried in mythology and the deep mists of time and so on. But I do think that's the case. And I think modern educational culture has largely swallowed the Lockean fantasy. You teach this thing called critical thinking skills. You've created some autonomous epistemic adult. But I think the contrary argument is going to raise questions about how far those individual thinking skills travel, because being good at thinking doesn't make you good at thinking about anything. It's more like a parking permit than a superpower. It's going to be valid in a specific zone, not across the whole city. You know, a brilliant chemist is not automatically a sound monetary theorist, a good novelist is not just a sabbatical away from becoming an epidemiologist. And so Plato has a healthier intuition here, that which does reconcile or link up with some of these ideas as distributed intelligence. You do not educate this free floating mind. You embed a person in practices that are much older than either the educator or the student, and those practices will slowly change what someone can see, what someone can do, and what someone can say.
Well, with all this in mind, let's bring it back to conspiracy theories. And you write that how we respond to conspiracy theories is not just an epistemic or a political question, but an ethical one. How so?
Well, there's a preliminary point, I guess, is that conspiracy theory, like pseudoscience, is not a neutral label. It's usually applied to views that we think are not just about conspiracies, but they are clearly wrong. And I'm fairly happy to own that ordinary usage. If a conspiracy theory turns out to be true, we were wrong to call it that. So the interesting question isn't so much about the term as such, although I understand that's a controversial position in the philosophical literature, but I think how we respond to what we're picking out is the more immediate question. The first thing I think we need to understand is that conspiracy theories are implicitly accusations. They claim that real people are malicious, deceptive, and often murderous, and that carries a moral cost. So when people say I'm putting a question out there, should we just contemplate it, we have to be very clear that conspiracy theories are always not just hypotheses, but they are modes of accusation. And I think we need to be aware that there is a moral cost in modes of accusation as forms of explanation. And second, I'd say that conspiracy thinking is both a symptom and a cause of institutional distrust. So mocking believers in conspiracy theories may feel good, and the media do enjoy often putting crazy people on air, but it rarely engages the ethical and the political issues. I suppose the thing is here, and I think this is an allied point, is that our confidence in our own reasoning is highly selective, and it is often highly selective when we think about conspiracy theorists. When an expert threatens my political identity, I'll research them into the ground. If it's got something to do with net zero or climate change, then that's fine. I'm going to be able to research and be anyone's equal. But when an expert, that is a surgeon, is holding a scalpel over my sternum, I'm suddenly a huge believer, it turns out, in consensus science. It's amazing then, you know, how quickly epistemological humility returns when the stakes involve a blade over one's own rib cage. So I think sometimes that we need to be clear that what is being challenged with conspiracy theories, we need to see it in the context of what and why something is being challenged, and where that supposed skepticism suddenly vanishes in a very convenient way. And I think that's going to help us diagnose partly what's at stake in these theories and why they're being upheld in particular circumstances.
Where we see conspiracy theory sort of defended and, you know, conspiracy theorists setting out their stall, so to speak, we often find not just a distrust of individuals, but a distrust of the institutions that have trained those individuals. And this whole discourse about how the media lies, universities are all captured by Marxists. And I wonder if you think that there we have a certain kind of acknowledgement of distributed intelligence. It may not be apparent to the person that's making that's sort of leveling that charge, but do you think that that's there, that that's sort of in the mix?
Yeah, I think so. And you know what? One of the things you need to acknowledge about that is that suspicion is often warranted. The fact is we have been betrayed by governments. We have been betrayed by scientific institutions and individual scientists. That would be something that we would need to acknowledge right up front rather than deny. The second thing is that in some respects, this is a much broader pattern that we see in modernity. Modernity really emerges in some ways with the critique of the church and monarchical power, which then becomes, you know, a critique that keeps going inwards and towards major institutions. After the Second World War, you have critiques of sovereignty, because suddenly it appears that a nation cannot be trusted to look after its own people. And we have the emergence of the International Declaration of Human Rights in response to this. So there is something about modernity which uses suspicion as one of its major modes. It's one of its temperamental modes. And there is a healthy version of that that I think is really, really important. But yes, I think it's true that when someone is so-called doubting the science, they're not doubting science. They are doubting the institutions that uphold scientific practice. And that, I think, is at least partly where we need to turn our attention if any kind of rehabilitation is going to be undertaken.
Well, you finished the paper with some interesting thoughts on trust and vulnerability and the kind of vulnerability that a concept of distributed intelligence requires. Tell me about that.
Well, if knowledge really is distributed across institutions and archives and so on, then none of us can know much of anything without placing our trust in others. And by trust, I don't mean some belief that something's probably reliable. You know, there's this idea, rationalist fantasy, that when we talk about trust, it's like, well, I'm going to make some rational decision that, you know, when I get into this cab, there's a 85% chance that they're not going to rip me off. Generally, what I mean by trust is a behavioral response to something, taking that taxi if you don't know the way, accepting a diagnosis or an operation from a heart surgeon that you can't fully check, acting on certain hypotheses or claims in climate science when you can't personally reproduce those results. And I think that conspiracy theories often refuse that kind, or think they refuse that kind of vulnerability. Of course, conspiracy theorists do trust, but they often trust influencers, anonymous posters, vaguely defined research communities that never really answer back in a particular way. And as I say, everyone wants to think for themselves right up until the point that the anaesthetist puts in the cannula. And the moment that your rib cage is involved, skepticism about institutional expertise suddenly evaporates. And if we can understand that selective trust, we might be able to rebuild a healthier ethics of knowing, and a sense that we are, a real sense that knowledge and knowledge claims are legitimately vulnerable, and they should be.
Chris Fleming, Associate Professor in the School of Humanities and Communication Arts at Western Sydney University and the author of On Doing Your Own Research, Conspiracy Theory, Distributed Intelligence and the Ethics of Knowing. That is a really good paper, recently published in the journal Subjectivity, and we've put a link to it on the Philosopher's Zone website. Thanks so much for your company this week. The Philosopher's Zone is produced on Bundjalung Country by me, David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me again next time. Bye for now.